Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Once We Were Punks, a fantastic new documentary about a gang of cabin boys and friends who rediscover rock and roll in their 50s. Chris Wasser is here with the week's new movie releases, including The Return and possibly The Last Conjuring, as well as a powerful new movie in the Swiss Hills. Plus, I get a sneak preview of the new Saipan movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well, and if you have children in your life, that they are all fully back to school, if they are of a school-going age. My eldest started secondary school, and it's all been going reasonably well and all, but not to overshare with you, but I had a bizarre dream in the middle of the week, an incredibly vivid dream. Don't worry, it's not going to get weird or anything, but I was back in school as the age I am now, and I was pleading with the powers that be in the school and the teachers to let me out, that I'd already been to school and I didn't need to go again. There you go. Paging Dr. Freud. I'm telling you. And it was so vivid. Like, it woke me up. And I don't have those dreams that, you know, wake you from your sleep, but this did. Terrifying stuff. But anyway, so I hope your school return has gone well and you're sleeping well and not restlessly. So listen, we better get to this.
What makes him a great player on the pitch makes him a pain in the ass off it.
Roy Keane is not going home.
People are one side or another.
Roy Keane's done nothing wrong.
I feel he's let down his country.
He can't be replaced.
He got us to the World Cup.
You're unmanageable.
No, it's you that can't manage. That's the problem.
I think it's a scare.
What a bad joke.
He's the best player we have.
You
earthquake shook the nation.
I don't think we're done.
You never tell me when we're done. I'm just getting started.
Now, it's back. Saipan. Remember it, 2002? The greatest argument in Irish history. More, a bigger civil war than the Civil War, some people claimed. I have vivid memories of a friend of mine and his dad falling out about it. Saipan, as you've been hearing about for a good while now, they've turned it into a movie. Steve Coogan plays Mick McCarthy. Aina Hardwick plays Roy Keane. And it was shown at the Toronto Film Festival on Thursday night. It got its world premiere. And I, along with a small other group of lucky people, actually got to see it. And the good news, folks, is it is great. Aina Hardwick is brilliant as Roy Keane. Physically, he has that same muscular kind of sveltness that Roy Keane, I mean, still has, but certainly had in 2002. And he inhabits him. He doesn't do an impression. He is brilliant as the mercurial Cork man. Steve Coogan is brilliant as Mick McCarthy. The movie is probably for a large part of it on the side of Roy Keane, in that when they get to Saipan, you see, and it's exaggerated to a certain extent, but there is truth in it, how ramshackle the facilities were. The pitch is terrible. There was no footballs. There was no sun cream. Now, that might sound, you know, is that not a bit David Beckham-esque? I didn't have any sun cream, but it was baking hot. They needed sun cream. The facilities were shocking. They were being served cheese sandwiches. The FAI suits, as Eamon Dunphy might refer to them as, were living on the hog. And then you have Mick McCarthy, who's kind of, as I say, played by Steve Coogan, a devotee of Jack Charlton. And when he gets to his hotel room, he puts a picture of Jack Charlton up, and he's almost like he's his, you know, his North Star. And it's almost like he's praying to Jack the whole time. I thought it was brilliantly done. And I think international audiences are going to be interested in it as well. Now, maybe they won't think it's as big a deal as we did, but it's a great movie. It really is. And the way they kind of handle the stuff back in Ireland is it's reportage. So you actually have the now sadly deceased Tommy Gorman, video of him doing the interview. You hear the late Jerry Ryan, Eamon Dunphy's voice and video is in there as well. So they reportage, so to speak, the action back in Ireland, and then the stuff in Saipan is obviously acted. One of the most tense moments in it is the recreation of when Mick and Roy finally almost come to blows, and the stuff Roy Keane says to him, and you're watching from behind your hands. And I'm not going to reignite the debate here, but you hear what he says to Mick McCarthy and you can't help thinking, yeah, I can see why he sent him home, but I'm not taking sides in this. This is a film show. But the good news is, Saipan, I saw the whole thing yesterday. It's a brilliant watch. It's going to be 90 minutes, really, really entertaining. And it will reopen the civil war of Saipan. And the other thing is, and this is not a sports show, but, and this is the day to be saying it to you, it really made me nostalgia for us being in the World Cup again. So here's hoping. Anyway, that is Saipan. You can't see it yet. It's going to be out later this year. We don't have an exact date yet. But the good news is, folks, it's a great watch and you will really, really enjoy it. Get in touch with me about anything you've been watching on the big or small screen. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address, or you can tweet me, John_Fardy. I'm also up on Instagram. Now, we get lots of emails. Don't always get to read them out, but I do want to quickly mention, it came in a week or two ago, but I'm only getting it to it now. Richard emailed saying nice things about the show. You can say bad things about the show as well. I'll still read them. But he was talking about doing a special. Sometimes we do specials about movies, about movies, or movies that have movies in them. Which is very good. And he gave me some examples like Blazing Saddles, The Player, Birdman, Get Shorty, Cinema Paradiso, Tropic Thunder, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think that's a great idea, Richard. I think that's going to be our next special whenever we do one. So thank you for that, Richard. As I say, do get in touch with anything that you've been watching. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
The storm is intensifying and is still pointed toward New Orleans. As a result of that, I am this morning declaring that we will be doing a mandatory evacuation.
When you wait to a point where a storm is already here, you might say it's mandatory, but it's unrealistic to move everybody because the resources aren't in place for that to happen.
Now, that was obviously referring to Hurricane Katrina, which has a sad milestone. It was 20 years ago that that happened. Just last week was the actual anniversary of the storm hitting. There is a new series on Netflix, great title, called Katrina Come Hell and High Water, which is the meat and potatoes treatment of Hurricane Katrina, the catastrophe that hit the city of New Orleans. Spike Lee is involved in this and directs one of the three-part episodes. It's all on Netflix now. It launched early last week. It basically goes through everything that you would want in this and replays the whole thing out and does it very well. And you were just struck by certain things, that New Orleans was, in essence, in a basin and anyone could see what was going to happen. And not to go down an engineering rabbit hole, but famously, there were levees and protectors in New Orleans because of its low-lying geography. And these levees and barriers were 17 feet high. The forecasting was forecasting waves of 20 and 21 feet. So it was a no-brainer that the place was going to flood. There is always this thing about, why didn't more people leave? This documentary makes it very clear why more people didn't believe. 140,000 people in the city did not have a car. You also see the chaos when people did try to leave. The roads were blocked. What I had, I guess, forgotten about, because it's been 20 years ago, which this documentary shows in brilliant fashion, is that when the storm hit, the damage wasn't obvious because the levee only broke subsequently. So the initial storm hit, it's bad, but it didn't look as bad as they thought it was going to be. Then the levee broke. Then places that you've heard of, like Treme and the Ninth Ward, all flooded. And it was chaos. And so many people died. And so many people were living on their roofs. So many people, of course, went to the Superdome and couldn't leave. It is all in there. There's a very interesting third episode directed by Spike Lee about what actually happened afterwards in terms of rebuilding, in terms of lessons learned, in terms of the elephant in the room, that this was a race issue. And they make a very compelling case for, you know, the lack of welfare and care that was shown to the people in New Orleans had a huge amount to do with race. If you don't believe me, watch this documentary. So I found it a terrific watch, if that's not a strange thing to say about something that's so sad. So that's Katrina, Come Hell and High Water on Netflix. A terrific watch. 3 episodes. It's all up there. It also features Wendell Pierce, who played Bunk in The Wire. He was also in Tremé, that subsequent HBO series about Katrina. He was born in New Orleans. He is brilliant in it. And they have all the players in it as well. And some bizarre footage of George W. Bush watching from Air Force One, flying overhead, not actually landing, just watching. So do check out Katrina, Come Hell or High Water on Netflix. Now, I have to mention, not in passing, but in full view, The Traitors on RT1. It started on Sunday night, the biggest TV event of the week. Siobhan McSweeney, The Traitors, has come to Ireland. This is very good. Pleasingly Irish. Siobhan McSweeney is terrific. I don't think I need to tell you what The Traitors is about. It's people trying to win money, betraying each other. There are the faithful and then there are the traitors. It's all taking place in Slane Castle. Siobhan McSweeney is terrific as the head honcho, corralling all these traitors and faithful people. The contestants, I like them all because none of them seem to me to be attempting to make careers in TV, which can often happen with, you know, these reality TV shows. They're hoping something's going to come of this. I think they're just playing the game. So they're all kind of pleasing characters, I have to say. This is good old-fashioned reality TV. Can you call reality TV old-fashioned? It's still relatively new, but you think I know what I mean. Now, I said on The Hard Shoulder early in the week when we were reviewing TV that, you know, it's not life-changing or it's not a TV revolution. And someone said, you're being a bit disingenuous. And maybe I am. My only point was that, you know, it's not... We've seen it before, but it's still very entertaining. And what I love is that people are tuning in, watching live TV. And I think that's a great thing. Old-fashioned, if I can use that phrase again. The Traitors on RTE is very good. No questions asked. I was just saying it's not a TV revolution or anything like that. But you know, not all revolutions will be televised. Anyway, after the break, Chris Wasser is here to talk about the week's new cinema releases. Hey, welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is The Conjuring: Last Rites. Yes, The Conjuring is back for its, I think, 9th installment, but this is going to be the last one by all accounts. And then a very different movie called The Courageous, a kind of social realist film set, I think, in Switzerland. Even though I have seen it, I'm not entirely sure what the country was. But someone who will know what the country was and who will be able to tell us what The Conjuring is all about is arts journalist and film critic and regular reviewer on this show, Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, how are you?
Very well, very well, despite my lack of geographic knowledge about the wider world, you know. So listen, let's start with, I suppose, the big new box office release of the week, The Conjuring: Last Rites. So I'm right in saying, like, even though this isn't that old a series, I think it only started at the turn of the last decade, this is its 9th iteration, and it's in the Conjuring universe, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, it's called The Conjuring Universe. That's the banner that hangs above these that hangs above The Conjuring door. We've had 9. This is the 9th film. This all started in 2013, but it's not the 9th Conjuring film, if that makes any sense. We've had 3 Conjuring films about, you know, Ed and Lorraine Warren, who I'll get to in a minute, played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. And then we've had 5 elaborate spin-offs that focus on the, you know, haunted paranormal entities that are in their little museum, you know, Annabelle, the dreadful plaything that just wrecks people's lives. And we've had those Nun films. They were a little bit odd. But this all
the
started...
The Nun films, people may be aware of, strange films, but they're part of the Conjuring universe.
They are, yeah. The Nun was initially introduced as a sort of, I think it was a painting in one of the original Conjuring films, but then the whole question mark about that character's background, we got 2 Nun films, but they weren't really that great. But this whole Conjuring universe started in 2012, 2013, when James Wan, And I've liked James Wan's films in this. I think sometimes when I think of James Wan, I'm a little bit, I think my opinion of him is tainted by those awful Aquaman films, but we won't get into that. But James Wan basically started a franchise around Ed and Lorraine Warren. Now, Ed and Lorraine Warren were two real people. They were married paranormal investigators, professional ghost hunters at a time when, you know, nobody believed in such a thing, and a lot of people still don't. And they investigated about 10,000 cases throughout the 70s and the 80s before going on to write very successful books on the matter. And they were they would just go to people's houses that were reportedly haunted, and they would sometimes, you know, exercise demons. They would see things that other people wouldn't. I mean, Ed was a demonologist. Lorraine claimed to be a clairvoyant and a medium. So there's it's rich material there, despite what you believe, what you might not believe for a film, and indeed a film series. So we got
a demonologist. Does yes. I mean, does an academic institute give you a slip of paper to say you are a demonologist?
Well, I was going to make fun. I was going to say, I think Ed is a self-taught demonologist. And I'm thinking, what's the difference? Where do we draw the line at this thing? But look, again, regardless of your belief in this thing, these films have been extraordinarily profitable. Among the most profitable films ever released, because each Conjuring picture, whether it's a film about Ed and Lorraine or a film about the evil playthings, they're very cheap to make. We're talking 20 to 40 million, not like, you know, $200 million, you know, superhero blockbusters here. And the returns on them, I mean, if you, you know, this film, this new Conjuring film hasn't yet been released, and already there's $2.2 billion in the Conjuring vault. That is just madness. For a series of horror films, ghost stories, and ghost stories aren't the kind of things that you think people will be coming back for, especially in a series where, you know, like, ghost stories aren't meant to be repeated. You know what's kind of going to happen, and the Conjuring has, that's one of the things that we'll get into, sort of repeated itself, but audiences seem to like coming back.
And I guess at source, though, they are not traditional, but they're this is the wrong phrase, but honest to goodness ghost stories in a way. I mean, they're not off the wall kind of stuff, or certainly in the early days they weren't.
Yeah, they're commercial horrors. This is not, you know, the, and I don't like this term, but this is not the elevated horror field.
No.
This is not independent horror cinema. You know, they are quite formulaic. They are quite glossy, very well made, you know, fine looking films. Some of them are quite beautiful looking, which is a weird thing to say about these things. And they kind of, you know, they're loving, they're almost a kind of love letters as well to the 1970s horrors that James Wan loved, you know. And they think they know at times that they're tipping their hat to the Exorcist here, and they're kind of, you know, saluting The Shining over here. They know what they're doing. They are sometimes a little too kind of pastiche, but look, they've been enormously successful. And at times, John, I think I've liked the Conjuring films more than the ones about your Annabelles and your nuns. But this one, unfortunately, might be a step too far.
Okay. Well, look, that's a very good preamble to where we are in this universe. But we come to the end now, The Conjuring Last Rites. So what's happening in this one? I mean, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, I do know her name because I think she's a terrific actress. I loved her in Up in the Air and all sorts of things. But they are back as Ed and indeed Lorraine.
They are, and the way this film has been marketed is the case that ended it all. And there seems to be a bit of confusion in the Conjuring Universe camp as to whether this is the final Conjuring film or just the end of this sort of phase when it comes to the Ed and Lorraine story.
Phases. I hate phases.
I know. I apologize. Again, I think they like to think that they're Marvel over there in Conjuring Towers. But look, we're in 1987. Well, actually, the film begins in 1964. It begins with the birth of Ed and Lorraine's daughter, Judy, played in adulthood by Mia Tomlinson. And I won't give anything away, but let's just say that the night that Judy is born, it coincides with a very sinister investigation into, you know, what else, a haunted house, and also something to do with haunted mirror. So it's a terrifying birth in more ways than one. We fast forward then to the mid-1980s, and it's very 1980s, you know, kind of, you know, big hair and shoulder pads and big power pop tunes on the radio. It's 1986, and at this point, Ghostbusters has been released, and that's not good for Ed and Lorraine. You know, as a result of that film, and, you know, people kind of, you know, making up their own minds about this thing, the ghost hunting enterprise has become a bit of a laughing stock. People no longer believe the stuff that Ed and Lorraine come out with. If you couple that as well with Ed's health concerns, you know, the old Ticker is in trouble. They basically have no choice but to wind down the family business, and they think they'll turn their hand to, you know, writing about their experiences instead. Mm. So wouldn't that be a great time for a huge haunting to occur over in Pennsylvania? So this is a real life case. As you know, all the Conjuring films are based on, you know, supposedly real life cases. You've got a family called the Smurls, and they have inadvertently welcomed a paranormal visitor into their home. It starts with Granny and Granddad bringing in a mirror. You know, I mentioned the haunted mirror. This mirror ends up in their house. And as usual, you know, this is the way these things usually go, John. The kids are the first to say, something's not right here. The adults kind of roll their eyes. And for some reason, it takes projectile vomiting. It takes people levitating. It takes, you know, ghostly figures running around the house with an axe before the grown-ups finally say, we need help. And that's where Ed and Lorraine come out of semi-retirement.
Aha, okay. I mean, I like the motif of Ghostbusters happening in the 80s and it kind of puts them out of business. That's clever. Does it stay clever then?
I don't think so. I mean, I just summed that up in a minute or two, but this thing is 135 minutes long. Yeah, exactly. That is, you know, that sound effect should be on the poster. That is far too long.
I am available.
That's far too long for a horror like this. And although, as I said, these things are well made, they are very well acted at times. It just takes a very long time to get to a destination that we've, you know, we know what's going on. Get us there a little bit quicker. And I think with previous Conjuring films, you had this situation where the horror aspect was the least interesting part of the films. And you touched on something there. That idea of Ed and Lorraine figuring out their place in a world that just no longer appreciates their services, this post-irony world where, oh, look at Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd busting ghosts. I ain't afraid of that. You know, why should we be afraid of these things that people are, if especially we don't believe in them? That stuff is fascinating. And I liked getting to know the Warrens a bit more at home. I liked this idea that Judy, as an adult, she's getting married to Ben Hardy. Ben Hardy plays her fiancé in this. Former EastEnders regular, he was in Bohemian Rhapsody, the X-Men films. I quite like him. Doesn't always make the best choices in terms of his acting career, but he is solid here. All that family stuff, all that, you know, passing on gifts, and you know, the kid, you know, has her mom's clairvoyant abilities, but she doesn't want them. That stuff is great. All the stuff about the hauntings in the house and the family not really believing at first, I like that. It's when you eventually get to the ghost train stuff in the final 40 minutes. It's just a bit all over the place.
Okay. And, you know, I always ask this with a horror, but it is the most important thing. Were you scared? Did you jump? Were you creeped out?
No, I was, you know, there's, you do get a chill from the setup. But the stuff that they really, you know, the stuff that Michael Chavez, who's the director here, it's not James Wan anymore, although he does work on the story. The stuff that they really want you to be scared at, it's not effective at all. By the time we actually do get to, and the film never really gets around this problematic issue, which is that it's about a haunted mirror. Mirrors, you can make dolls scary, you can make nuns and priests scary, you can't make a mirror scary. So when you have, you know, the characters of this long-standing franchise standing off against the mirror, it's a bit ridiculous. And I think the ends, a little bit like the last Conjuring film, some of the nun pictures as well, it's all crash bang wallop. You know, you expect from a film that's been, you know, that's been marketed as the case that ended it all, to be explosive, to have shocking twists, you know, stray away, even if it stray away from the real life stuff, you know, like do something bananas with these characters. If you know, go out on top. Instead, we're just kind of getting, you know, reheated twists, jump scares that aren't effective, sloppy ghost train antics that, you know, only if you're easily startled you would be frightened of. The whole time I just kept thinking, there is a decent film in here. And I should mention too that Wilson, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, they're wonderful together. They really are. There's a lovely lived-in chemistry between those two, and you buy them as friends, partners, and a married couple. And I just love if they had a better film around them.
Well, that sounds average, I guess. I do disagree with you, though, about mirrors. I think they can be very scary if used rightly. Plus, Leonard Cohen was asked once, did he like what he saw when he looked in the mirror every morning? And he said, it depends who's standing behind me. So I do think you can do lots with mirrors. But anyway, a reheat of sorts. So what are you going to say stars-wise for The Conjuring Last Rites?
Actually, yeah, let me correct myself. I do agree. Remember Presence, which we reviewed earlier this year with Steve, that final... I won't spoil it, but the stuff with the mirror towards the end of the film is genuinely terrifying. But what
I
mean,
the Soderbergh movie,
it's terrific, underappreciated as well. But when you have Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga and all of their, you know, Ghostbuster gang, like, you know, fighting a mirror, it's just a bit, yeah. It's just a bit ridiculous.
I hear you.
As I said, I think there is a decent film in there somewhere. I think it's brilliantly acted. I think Bo Gadsden and also a British-Irish talent, Keira Lord Casty, I think they all perform very, very well. And this film does really set itself up to be the last, but I think they're going out in a bit of a whimper, unfortunately. So I'm actually going to go with 2.5 stars out of 5.
Okay. Sounds about fair. Yeah, 2.5 stars. That's for The Conjuring Last Rites, which is in cinemas from Friday, the 9th of September. Although, interestingly enough, I did see online, it's released on the 3rd in the Philippines for some strange reason. I'm not sure if there's ghostly implications in that. So let's take a quick clip of The Conjuring Last Rites.
Don't touch anything. Everything you see in here is either haunted, cursed, have been used in some sort of ritualistic practice. Nothing's a toy. Not even the toys.
How many cases you guys had?
Cases?
My name is Ed Warren, here with my wife Lorraine.
Maybe 1,000. Every case is different. Every family's different. Once we start, there's no going back. Anything can happen.
A clip there from The Conjuring Last Rites, which Chris Rosser gave an underwhelming, reheated was his phrase, 2.5 stars. Chris, something very different. The polar opposite, I would suggest, is The Courageous, a Swiss movie, if I'm not mistaken, which is getting a limited release. And now I have seen this as well. What's going on in this? I mean, you could be flippant about it and say Ken Loach in the Swiss Hills.
Oh, that's, yeah, well, that's very good. They should put that on the poster. We're coming out with all of them this
week.
That's
two this week. This is
great. Here we go. We're with a character named Jewel, played by Ophelia Cole from Call My Agent. And we're straight in here. You know, she is just unraveling when we first encounter her. She is, and this story kind of peels, like I might provide a very simple synopsis, but when you're watching it, it actually peels itself back layer by layer. It takes a while to kind of tell you what it's about, actually. But I thought it explained itself very well. But anyway, Jewel is unemployed and also unrealistic about her financial prospects. She really has run out of money, but she doesn't want to let her kids know that. She wants to shield her kids from, you know, every cruelty that's, you know, kind of happening to her and that's happened in her past. She's a little bit eccentric, a little bit rebellious, and she's started lying to her kids about their living arrangement. The kids think that they're going to be moving to a bigger house down the road because they're going to be moving out of their current flat. In reality, Jewel hasn't paid the rent and they're being kicked out of the other flat. And it's a wonderful scene in there where other people are coming to look at it, the landlord standing aside, and the kids just don't know what's happening because Jewel is protecting them from the truth. So thankfully, the boys are away in their own little worlds, but you always have that one older child, in this case, Jewel's daughter, who is, you know, beginning to suspect trouble in the adult sphere. I think she knows that something is not right here. And there's little kind of teases throughout. I won't give too much away, but there's an electronic tag on Jewel's ankle, which kind of tells us there's definitely a story here. Something has happened to her in terms of her, you know, potentially her past partnership with the kid's dad, potentially, you know, the reason why she's no longer employed and can't get a job. You're constantly thinking, where did this all go wrong? But what Jewel is thinking is, where can it go right? How can I fix this? Yeah. And the way she tries to fix this is to secure funds to do what she thinks, or to do what the kids think she's doing anyway, to buy them a new house.
Yeah. And it's funny, and we don't want to give too much away, but the onion thing you said is bang on, because even the reveal of the electronic tag is so cleverly done. It really is. And even the, you know, you mentioned that the people are overlooking at the house because she's going to move out. I didn't get that straight away. Like, some of this, it refactors as it goes on. So as an audience member, you're really peeling that onion as you watch it.
Yeah, it's funny because Jewel is trying to not just convince her kids that everything is okay, but herself. And then at the same time, not just herself, but us, because that scene where she is showing her, they essentially break into the house and she shows the kids around and they're picking their bedrooms. And you're absolutely right. You don't really know what's going on, but you start to buy Jules' lie. And I was sitting there thinking, oh, maybe she does. She actually, I said she breaks in. She seemed to know the alarm code. What's going on? And then something happens where you realize it's all one big, you know, facade. It's all big, one big lie that she's telling herself just to get through the day. I really thought this was just wonderful. And I think
so did I. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you know. Sorry, go on.
No, you go on.
Oh no, I was going to say that we've had a pretty good run of European social realism on the big screen over the last couple of months. I was thinking recently the Dardenne Brothers, Young Mothers, which is set in a home for adolescent mothers in Belgium. It won Best Screenplay at Cannes. It's brilliant. It's actually still in cinemas now at the minute. You've had Late Shift, which followed a nurse during basically a nighttime shift in a hospital. And now you have this, which what ties all these films together is that they're stories that could so easily collapse into just shouty melodrama, but instead they're just naturalistic, truthful, subtle, and so poignant and powerful. I had a great time with this.
Yeah, so did I. And the thing is, what I liked about it was that I felt played a bit like an accordion with her, the mother, in that at times I was so sympathetic to her, and other times I felt like saying, come on now, you need to ante up here and do what's right by your kids. And I don't mean to sound like some right-wing fanatic, but go get a job. Like, just, you need to mind these kids. And particularly when we see them at the start, she kind of leaves them for a while. But I loved it. And two quick things en route to me giving you your right to give it a star rating. A caution advised, I found it very sad. It was hard to watch at times, and you know, people may be looking for a little light relief. This is not it, but that will be apparent from even the poster. And secondly, and more importantly, and I'm not giving any kind of spoiler, but I absolutely love the ending, because I thought it was so ambiguous, and so, well, maybe not ambiguous, but certainly open to interpretation, even though I think I know what happened. I just thought it had a beautiful ending in it. So I thought this was great too. What would you say stars wise for The Courageous, which is getting a limited release this
week? It is, yeah. I like that Yasmin Gordon making her directorial debut here. Yasmin has made short films and I think maybe documentary pieces before, but I like that she didn't feel the need to tie everything up in a bow. It's about a single mother of three, you know, fighting for her family, fighting for her dignity. It's a story of redemption, slippery slopes, second chances, and how, you know, some people are just not allowed them. And I thought Cole performed it wonderfully. And you're absolutely right. She's a character and it's a performance that's impossible to turn away from. But that doesn't mean that this character is easy to like. You know, she does things here that make her extraordinarily difficult to like, but you can't take your eyes off her. And also, John, 80 minutes, that's a good run time. So I'm going to go with 4 stars.
And not a scary mirror in sight either. That's 4 stars for The Courageous, which is getting a limited release, but do check it out. A little sad, but very poignant and beautifully made. Chris Wasser's giving it 4. I would concur wholeheartedly with 4 stars for The Courageous. And before that, he gave The Conjuring Last Rites 2.5 stars. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Up next, Once We Were Punks. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, Once We Were Punks is a new documentary by director Frank Schuldeis. The film follows the fortunes of a punk rock band from Ballybor in Cavan, originally called the Panic Merchants, who started in the 80s when the big breakthrough never came. Careers, adulthood, emigration, children, all that stuff intervened. But then a loose and wry conversation at a funeral 25 years later, see them pick up where they left off and now line out as the Sons of Southern Ulster, which you may have heard about. And somewhat unexpectedly, they book a gig in Whelan's, which sold out. The film, Once We Were Punks, will be shown as part of the IFI Documentary Film Festival running from the 10th to the 14th of September. That show was sold out, so there was another one on the 15th. It was directed by Frank Schuldeis, as I said, who spoke to us a few years ago for his documentary, The Man Who Wanted to Fly, all about Bobby Coote, who wanted to get into the skies. Frank joins me in studio, clearly trying to corner the market for inspiring stories from Cavan. Frank, hello, sir.
Yeah, the obsession continues, John.
Listen, I'm always fascinated by documentary makers. When you follow people for a while, right, and you commit to something, you don't know what's going to happen. Like Louis Theroux talks about this as well. You decamp to follow these 4 guys, right? Or you go to Bobby in Cavan with his plane. Like, it's a commitment. Are you worried when you set out on this? Like, what if this doesn't go anywhere?
It would have been a concern, and if Bobby Coote hadn't gone anywhere, it would have been a bigger concern. But actually, halfway through, the man who wanted to fly, he hadn't gone anywhere.
Yeah.
We didn't know if he was going to. So, yeah, this time around, it started in a very kind of uncertain direction. But the longer I spent with the four lads from the band, two of them live outside Ireland, and so I was in contact with them. But the more time I spent on it, the more I was convinced there was something in it. Mm. What it was, I didn't know. And that would have actually gone for over a year, year and a half before it began to take shape. And it, maybe in a way, that's it just led me to where the story went.
And what was it about this story? Like, these guys have a band, the Panic Merchants, that it's fair to say very few people had ever heard of. They had a single or two, if I'm reading the documentary correctly. So what was the, was it, you know, I'm approaching middle age, you're approaching it as well, I'm sure.
I'm there.
You're in it. Yeah. Was it this idea of, you know, it's never too late?
The genesis, the whole thing began in a very unlikely sort of way. I was literally driving home and I heard a song on the radio.
Okay.
And the song, it was The Pop In by a band. I didn't know who it was. I'd never heard the song. There was something about the sound of the song. It was the way the guitar played. I knew that the singer was from Dublin.
Mm.
But it was the guitar sound reminded me of bands from the mid to late 80s. And I was just really curious as to who is this and how come I've never heard it before. So even when then the band was announced or named, identified at the end, that it was the Sons of Southern Ulster, that meant absolutely nothing to me.
Yeah.
And it piqued my curiosity. And there began the story. I started looking into it. One thing led to another. And here we are. That was, it took about 4.5 years.
Yeah. The commitment of a documentary always surprised me. Let's get to the documentary. You mentioned the lead singer, Justin Kelly. He kind of is the lead singer who roars out these words, sometimes almost in spoken word fashion. I mean, sometimes he's singing as well. They're definitely, it's a punk delivery. We have David Marr, who's kind of his co-guy in a way. He's the guitarist. Noel Larkin, brilliantly on drums. Paddy Glacken, who's now in Australia when the movie begins, who's brought back in on bass. Justin, and I don't know if we want to leave this up to people to see the movie, but he moves to Ballyborough when he's a small kid. There's a lot of issues in his life that he's still dealing with. Do you want to tell people his rough background?
Yeah, well, his father, James, it came from Ballyborough originally, but James just wasn't his father. His father was Captain James Kelly, who was at this epicenter of the arms trial. And in actual fact, this is how the Kelly family ended up. This is why a singer with a Dublin accent ends up singing for a band, punk band from Cavan. And because the family had to relocate at the end of the arms trial. They were impoverished. Captain Kelly had to leave the army.
He couldn't get work.
There was no work. He actually applied for a job as a street sweeper with Cavan County Council and was turned down. There was a penury about what they were put through, which I think informs the songs and definitely informs the lyrics.
Yeah.
So they ended up in Ballyborough because that's where he'd come from, and they ended up so Justin's father took over a bar that his brother used to run.
Yeah.
And that's what relocated them. So they had originally come from Terenure in Dublin South. So it was, if you're looking back at the 80s, this was a bit of a translocation, really.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, they mentioned Spinal Tap once or twice in it. And it's not Spinal Tap, right? But one thing I did think of at times was the documentary Anvil, which was somewhat similar. Now, Anvil veers towards a joke at times, even though it was a true story. And if people haven't seen the documentary Anvil, it is great.
It's about
this heavy metal band getting back together who were nearly big in the 80s. Well, kind of big in the 80s. But at the same time, there is a lot of tension in this, as in, is this going to go anywhere? I mean, did the similarities between Anvil ever strike you?
You have no idea how delighted I am that you're referring to Anvil, because I loved Anvil. I thought it was fantastic. And there are absolute similarities, because what we're talking about here is four mates childhood mates.
Yeah.
Anvil was about two main guys who were mates growing up and who had a dream. So there's an absolute cross comparison.
Yeah.
Say with these, I suppose the difference is that for them, as they grew up, and then the, you know, the for school, jobs, family, careers, they two of them left the country. So when they split up and the Panic Merchants ended, that was it. There was no going back.
Yeah.
And conspicuously enough, none of them joined other bands in the meantime. So
I think the drummer says at one point, "I didn't even miss the music," which seemed kind of incongruous to me.
Yeah, Noel says
no.
He put the drum kit under the stairs and never took it out.
Yeah.
And Paddy, who he went to the UK, then he went to the Middle East and ended up in Australia. He said he brought his bass guitar with him and never took it out of the case. So they whether they need each other, they definitely spark off each other. And without that, for David, who's the musical genius, I think, behind the band and a brilliant guitarist.
Yeah.
But Justin and David are a bit like Morrissey and Marr to me, in that, you know, even though Dave Marr is not related to Johnny Marr, but it's just that, you know, the lyrics and the music, and it's guitar led.
Yeah.
With a really solid bass.
Yeah. There's a couple of things I want to ask you, but I kind of don't want to give spoilers because I do think there's beautiful moments of Second Chances and all that kind of stuff. But just a couple of things. They are, and this isn't any kind of spoiler, like at one point he says, you know, Cavan Monaghan and Donegal, the North didn't want us. Irish people didn't give a shit about us. This is very much, border music is the wrong term, but they're wearing their Cavanness on their sleeves, and it comes across kind of cool. Like, Cavan is front and center in this. I know you're a dub, you're telling me beforehand, but they clearly wanted that out in front in everything they do.
Yeah, well, my granny from Ballyhays would be only thrilled to hear that. But it's place is essential here.
Yeah,
just like the friendship is at the core of the film.
Yeah. Yeah.
But place, it's where they come from.
Yeah.
And the fact that two of them emigrated and Justin is writing lyrics, he's writing lyrics about the town he grew up in, which wasn't the town that he was born in. And so it's a bit like a later acceptance, really.
Yeah.
Because if you went from Dublin to Ballyburgh and you thought this is quite provincial, as here he was as a, you know, as a kid, and then trying to be cool and wondering, why am I here? Then by the time he left there, he began to see what was really actually quite appealing, and what a fabulous place to grow up.
Yeah. I'm not going to give spoilers, as I say, but I do have to ask you, they do a gig before the Whelans gig that doesn't go well. Were you in the back going, oh, because I was?
pretty uninspiring stuff. And when they came
out, a restless audience, let's say.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's make you think of bands playing in pubs in a corner where nobody is there for the music.
Yeah.
Nobody's really listening. What people put themselves through to perform, you know?
Yeah.
But I think, when they came off stage that night and the following night, they had Whelans, which was the gig of their lifetime.
Yeah.
And I think there was a few uneasy nights or an uneasy sleep for a few of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, people are going to have to watch it if they want to know how the Whelans gig goes and wants to know how they are there now. As I say, it's part of the IFI Documentary Festival, which is brilliant every year and has all sorts of great things on it this year, including Frank's movie, Once We Were Punks. But do check out ifi.ie for more information on that. So it's going to be shown on the 12th, which is sold out, Frank.
It is, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So why are you here? No, it's going to be on the 15th then as well in the IFI, isn't it?
This is what happened in Galway. In Galway at the FLA, the film sold out in 35
Brilliant.
Minutes. And they added a second screening, which sold out as well. I think there's an appetite for it.
Yeah.
So we're actually looking, with the help of Screen Ireland, we're looking at a release probably in the new year, probably looking at around February.
A proper full-out cinema release.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, brilliant.
We want to get it out there. I think there's an appetite for it.
You don't need me to tell you about your film, but I do watch a lot of films, and I think this is going to go very well for you because it is that thing of second chances and hope, and maybe that thing I did as a teenager that I thought wasn't going to go anywhere could still go somewhere. So I do hope it travels far because it's worthy of it. Let me ask you this in closing. The lads, they're, you know, sparky fellows. At one point, one of them says, you know, we can't say this stuff to each other, so we sing it to each other. Have they seen it? Do they?
They were very generous, actually. They didn't ask to see any cuts,
yeah.
anything we'd shot. So the first time they saw it was sitting in the audience at Galway,
wow.
at the Fla. And it was a lot to ask them because yeah. here, if you've been shooting over 4 years,
yeah.
you may not remember every single interview
yeah.
and every remark that you made over the last 4 years. But they sat and there was a fantastic response to it. And for me, yeah, my only concern, I felt that they were represented in it. And you always wonder, you do wonder. But thankfully, they were happy enough afterwards, yeah.
Happy enough. And then finally, I presume when, even from the few showings it's having, the more it has, their songs might, you know, get a few more plays and people might buy some more vinyls. And
well, the coincidence was when Sons of Southern Ulster formed, seeing as they weren't that before, they set out to make three albums. And
yeah.
just in the same week that we had the premiere in Galway, they released the third album. It's on Spotify.
Okay.
And there's a couple of tracks. There's one in particular that we use in the film that I think is just outstanding. And it's so they have actually got to where they set out to go.
Yeah.
And the question for them is what to do next, you know, because there will be another goal.
So. Yeah, the difficult fourth album, maybe. Well, the Sons of Southern Ulster are the focus of Frank Scholdeis's great new documentary called Once We Were Punks. It's going to be shown as part of the IFI Documentary Festival on the 12th. However, that is sold out. They are doing another screening on the 15th in the IFI and look forward to a release early next year. Frank, thanks a million.
Thanks a million, John.
Probably had a bit of a fractious relationship with Ireland in general. This is a good way of making a little peace with the past.
I suppose it was just a point of realising that something that started off as a crazy conversation at a funeral ended up with us doing this.
I served drink to Roaring Johnny on the night that he passed, trampled above in the byre.
We came back to Bailaborough from England about 1975, 76. It was like going out to the Wild West, and then actually to move to the Wild West to live was fabulous. Now look, all of Ireland was mad back then, but I think it was particularly mad in and around the border counties, you know.
A clip there from Once We Were Punks, which is being shown as part of the IFI Documentary Film Festival. And there's a screening of it outside of the festival on the 15th in the IFI. And you heard me talking there to its director, Frank Scholdeis. And he's hoping to get a cinema release early next year. And do check out ifi.ie to get more information about their splendid documentary festival, which is splendid every year. And indeed, the IFI is splendid. And I'm on no retainer whatsoever. It's just a great place in the heart of Dublin City. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, we will re-enter one last time the gates of Downton Abbey. So that's to come next week. In the meantime, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Get in touch with me at any stage. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend, and I will talk to you all next week.